From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the program, in examining racial disparities, why the term racism often causes more problems than it solves.
The label racist forecloses so much conversation, right? And so, and I almost think it, we live in a moment where there is more anxiety about being labeled a racist than there is about racial inequality.
Later, a West Dallas native talks about her budding Hollywood success for her acting and now her screenwriting.
You see a certain thing, especially on the TV screen, but sometimes even on the film screen. It's rather monodimensional. It's like, no, let's show the pimples. Let's show the wrinkles and the tears and the trips that a character can make.
And some hard times were the catalyst for Peter Mulvey's rockin' new album. Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in. For the past several months, Lake Effect and WUWM News have been examining the high rate of incarceration of African-American men in the Milwaukee area. We've looked at the impact on both the black and the broader community, and in the coming weeks, we'll look towards solutions to the issue. We've also discussed some of the myriad causes of the problem, and some have spoken about what they see as racially discriminatory practices at several levels. While some lump that concept in under the umbrella term racism, our first guest this morning would urge you to understand the distinction between the two concepts. Dr. Imani Perry is professor at Princeton University's Center for African American Studies. She was one of Marquette University's three Metcalf chairs this semester and talked last month about the persistence of racial inequality in Milwaukee. She joined us in the studio last month as well. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
One of the key points, maybe the key point you make in your work, is that despite the fact that racism as maybe an overt act is not as prevalent in this country as it once was, racial discrimination and inequality still persists. What are you getting at? What do you mean by that, and how is it most evident?
Sure. So one of the things that sort of guided the entire project is this reality that on the one hand, we're a country that since the mid-60s has proclaimed a commitment to equality, to egalitarianism. And I do think that that virtue is held sincerely. At the same time, we see not just deep inequality along the lines of race, but also what I call practices of inequality. So I get to that by looking at research in economics and sociology and political science and neuroscience and all of these different fields. And what you see is there are patterns where people disadvantage others on the basis of race. And so the prevalence of these patterns is really extraordinary. And so I tried to puzzle through, how does this happen? How is there such a disjuncture between our stated values and our practices? How do we learn this behavior? And I really come to the conclusion that this is not how we think about, we conventionally think about racism as like animus, right? I don't like this person because of who they are. It's not that so much as it is the ways we're socialized to see other people. This happens through popular narratives about different groups. This happens through the way that we organize society and the kind of categories that we place people into. This happens through the kind of spaces we see people occupying, like kind of geographies, neighborhoods, and the like. And so I wanted to talk about how to understand racial inequality as a cultural practice, and then to think about how do we begin to undo those cultural practices.
Well, what are some of those popular narratives that you talk about that maybe are common, but people who aren't paying attention don't realize that that's what these narratives are about?
Right. So I think that's a great question. So for example, things like African Americans don't value education or don't want to work or have been so damaged by the history of racism that they are unwilling to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. Those, and I think it's important to say, those narratives are not held by members of one political party or another, and not necessarily held by groups of members of a particular racial group. I mean, I think they're sort of when I say it's part of American culture, it's pervasive. So it's not a kind of one-way thing. It's the way – so that you even have people within that group believing those narratives. It's just always not them. It's somebody else, right? who has a – and so I think it's just – it's an indication. And part of why this happens is because, you know, we look at the world around us. We see that different people tend to live in different places – to occupy different locations in our society, and we don't understand why.
I was just going to ask, right. if we're just not asking why.
We're not asking why, and so part of what our brains do is we fill in the gaps to explain what we see. We tell stories, and we repeat stories. So, for example, when I teach my students, when I ask my students, why do you think there's a racial wealth gap, before they have been through a semester of my class, and they often think, well, different rates of savings or different commitments to home ownership and the like. And then when I tell them, well, in fact, in the 20th century, the mid-20th century, the federal government had discriminatory policies that led to differences in home ownership rates and values of homes, right? And so I think that's – now, these are students who are not presuming any inferiority. They just don't know, right? And so part of this, I talk in the book about shifting our narratives, is to tell a fuller story in order to undo the way racial narratives guide our behavior.
Would you contend that the getting past the intentional part of racism was maybe the easy part? Not that it went quickly, but in some ways it seems like shifting that sort of straight ahead, I don't like people because of the color of their skin, is a much easier thing to wrap your head around than this post-intentional racism.
I think – right. I think it is something that's easier to wrap one's head around, although it places us in this bizarre conundrum. So there was – when people saw inequality and racial bigotry was a norm, then it was easy to understand what was going on. When the average American is walking around saying, I don't believe in racial inequality, and trying to make sense of this society that is unequal, and then feeling deeply uncomfortable about talking about race, right? It makes a really difficult kind of, you know, soup of things that we're having to deal with. So this is the harder part, but it's also difficult because there was so much unfinished business after the Civil Rights Revolution. And so it's not entirely surprising that this is where we are at this point.
I wonder if part of the issue is that for many white people, they hear the phrase racial discrimination and they say, well, that can't be because I'm not a racist.
Right. And I think the problem is the label racist forecloses so much conversation, right? And so – and I almost think we live in a moment where there is more anxiety about being labeled a racist than there is about racial inequality. And so when I talk about practices of inequality, I'm not talking about what we mean generally when we say someone is a racist, a feeling of animus. But the reality is that I, as an African-American woman, if I go to purchase a car, I am more likely to pay more. Right. I don't think that the person is looking at me and saying, I want this black person to pay more. But I do think that something is happening about the sense of identification or disidentification with me as a buyer that leads me to have to pay more. Or, you know, it happens in housing or in medical care, you know. So you see doctors much less likely to order more extensive testing for African Americans. Some of that is even related to this idea that African Americans are less likely to be compliant with respect to taking medication. That's true, but the question should be not – the answer is not to deny treatment, but rather to say, well, why are they less likely to be compliant? And so I think, you know, it's – practices of inequality don't require any conscious animus. What they depend upon, though, is ways of seeing people and how we tell stories based upon what we see when we look at someone.
Well, and so let's take those couple of examples, say the practice of inequality in medical care or the practice of inequality in terms of buying a house or a car. How do we start to unpack those and push the needle back towards equality in cases like that?
Yeah. I mean, I think there are many ways to approach this. So one way is to – and this is the way that sometimes people have done this in medicine – is actually create more stringent standards of care, period, right? So that everybody who we see having these set of symptoms has to have these types of outcomes, so that there's not the space for the exercise of discretion. It's difficult to say we want to get rid of discretion. On the one hand, discretion helps us work with some kind of nuance. You know, different situations are different, right? Do we want everything so tightly regulated? On the other hand, it's where there is discretion is where we see practices of inequality occurring. They occur across lines of political difference, across lines of ethnic difference. And so one response is to have a sort of a higher level of standards of care. Another kind of response, which is a broader cultural response, is to begin to be more explicit about these about this evidence, right? One of the things that a lot of social cognition research shows is that when people become aware that certain behaviors are associated with racial inequality, they are more capable of self-correcting. And so if you say, oh, this is the kind of thing where you all where discrimination always happens, then it gives people information that enables them to watch themselves and make sure that they're acting in a fair fashion. And so the bizarre thing is that, you know, because it's so impolite to talk about race in this country, then we don't give ourselves the opportunity to do that.
Well, and it sounds like the conversation you're hoping takes place, or the new narrative, if you will, is one that isn't necessarily accusatory. It's just putting this on people's radar screens.
Exactly. I mean, I think the problem and this is a problem for in terms of what happened in constitutional law. We began to identify racial inequality in terms of individual actions, bad actors. And that's a problem because race is a cultural and social phenomenon. It is not individual. It has, you know, the only way that we can see these patterns is in accumulation. In each individual case, you can probably find a reason for a multitude of potential reasons that any person made a decision, right? So you can't rely upon saying this action was racist, right? What you have to do is create safeguards and ways of reshaping how people talk and think about things that enable – that reduce the accumulation or the patterns as opposed to focusing on the individual actor.
The situation currently exists. We at this radio station actually have spent the last few months looking into the issue of the high rates of African-American male incarceration in Milwaukee County. And I'm curious to get your take on how this dynamic plays into that equation. I mean, the narrative tends to go along the lines of, at one level, there's a group of people that point to the fact that so many African-American males are incarcerated. And then on the other side, you have people saying, well, African-Americans are also disproportionately victims of crimes.
That's right.
And so I guess if you were to take your look at transcending racial inequality in this context, how would you start to unpack that situation, if you will?
That's a great question. I mean, one of the things that I immediately turn to is that at every stage of the process of law enforcement, there's evidence of the practices of inequality. So rates of stop, right, the decision to pursue a case, what the person is going to be charged with. And it doesn't just fall along lines of race where in like circumstances, African-American defendants tend to be treated more harshly, right, from arrest to conviction. But it also has to do with color. So darker-skinned African-Americans are much more likely to be convicted with longer sentences than lighter-skinned African-Americans. So once we know that, right, that to me occasions something that we need to actually sound some alarm bells over, particularly given that the rate of incarceration is so astronomical in the United States and that felony conviction really kind of disables people for the rest of their lives in terms of employment and in terms of being productive members of the society, right? I would add that the rates of incarceration have gone up dramatically. Now they're just starting to dip, but they've gone up dramatically even as crime has been reduced, right? So I would want to I would advocate taking approaches that are actually – that is as opposed to the kind of tough-on-crime law and order response, which has coincided so tightly with practices of racial inequality, to think strategically and carefully about how do we reduce crime, right? And that has a lot to do with employment, right? That has a lot to do with various kinds of social services, as opposed to a response that is carceral, because a carceral response is just in some ways just triggers practices of inequality in ways that are particularly pernicious.
Well, and in this case, would you say more discretion is better?
More discretion is absolutely not better, because the more discretion there is, we found even with both juries and judges, the more discretion there is more discrimination. Now, discretion, on the other hand, though, with respect to not having mandatory sentences is productive, because mandatory sentences have been, you know, have just increased incarceration just exponentially. But we do want to have some pressure to treat like cases in like fashion. And also the incentive structure for prosecutors, right, to pursue a higher conviction rate is deeply problematic, right? over 90% of cases never go to trial, right? The plea bargaining system is broken. People don't get their day in court. So there's all these procedural matters that are also fueling this kind of deep inequality and crisis of mass incarceration.
Your book on the subject, More Beautiful and More Terrible, came out 3 years ago, I think, in the midst of President Obama's first term in office. And when Barack Obama was elected, there were all these discussions about whether we are living in the post-racial society. And that almost seems like a quaint storyline in 2014.
Right.
There's plenty of evidence that we are not in a post-racial society. Do you think there's been any progress at all in terms of achieving racial equality? Has the Obama administration to this point or these Obama years had any legacy in terms of moving the needle?
I don't think so. I mean, I think there's some sort of modest emotional impact that comes from, you know, it is a big transition to imagine the leader of the United States and what people call the leader of the free world as a person of African descent. That's a dramatic shift. But in terms of the lives of African Americans generally, absolutely not at all. And in point of fact, these have been the years of the greatest economic devastation in the past 40 years. So that the impact of the subprime mortgage lending crisis has basically halved the relative wealth of African Americans, and it's also devastated the wealth of Latinos. And these are years of the incredibly devastating impact of high rates of deportation. And so we have to get beyond the thinking of race in symbolic terms. In fact, in a somewhat prophetic moment, the first title of this book was The First Black President. That was before Obama announced his run. And part of the idea was I was going to say we could have the first black president without shifting anything about racial inequality in this country. That title didn't stick, but I think I anticipated what was going to happen, right? We have these exceptional figures who can transcend everything, and yet people, the large groups, are not necessarily impacted by that.
Well, Imani Perry, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Best of luck. Dr. Imani Perry is professor at Princeton University's Center for African American Studies and faculty associate in Princeton's program in law and public affairs. She was one of Marquette University's three Ralph Metcalf chairs during this semester and spoke last month on the Milwaukee campus. We'll take a quick break now, and in just a moment, a West Allis native making a name for herself in Hollywood, both for her acting and for her writing. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. Actress and West Allis native Chudi Chu has been making a name for herself in Hollywood. She's had parts in the films Beautiful and The Internship and has had recurring roles on highly rated TV shows as well, including Weeds, The Closer, and Southland. But her newest starring role is as a screenwriter. Pretty Rosebud has already won a number of awards at film festivals, including Best Actress for Chu and Best Screenplay. Pretty Rosebud tells the story of Sissy, a young Asian-American woman who seems to have everything but is struggling to find her way. The film is screening around the country now and will be shown at the Marcus Majestic Cinema in Brookfield tonight. Tu spoke with Lake Effect's Bonnie North and told her that this was the first film that she both wrote and produced.
Now, I've written other screenplays, but this is the first one that's actually getting to see the light of day on the big screen. So it's really exciting.
And it's also something that you star in as well. So you wore many hats on this.
I did. And I have to say, with each hat comes a particular stress level. So if you imagine, you know, like a thermostat, imagine that I was constantly in the 100s. Because it's high stress level.
Well, obviously it paid off because it's won some awards already for the Idlewild International Film Festival. You got Best Actress and Best Screenplay for that. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And so now it's starting to hit the country, and it's coming here tonight.
Yes. I'm so excited because people are coming out of the woodwork, and I feel very blessed and honored that that people are coming. I mean, you know, some people that I haven't seen since grade school and high school and former fellow piano students and all, you know, everyone coming out of the woodwork. So I'm feeling so much love from my peeps in Milwaukee.
Now, where did you grow up?
I grew up in West Dallas, kind of like Highway 100 in Oklahoma, around there. Yeah, just a little bit west of there, almost to Berlin.
So it must be really special to bring this back, having already won awards with it.
Yes. In fact, with or without awards, just the fact that I'm having, you know, friends from everywhere coming out to support, I just feel very honored and blessed.
Well, let's talk about the film. It's called Pretty Rosebud, and in some ways it's autobiographical. You are in it, and the character that you play has parents of the same racial makeup that you do, Chinese and Filipino. And it's such an interesting examination of what it means to be good, if that's a fair way to put it.
That's a perfect way to put it. In fact, the script has gone through so many different drafts and renditions, you know, different plot points, different characters. And it's funny you should say good, because a previous title was The Good Girl, or just plain Good Girl. And, of course, that ended up being a film, The Good Girl, that Jennifer Aniston did, you know, several years back. And although we could have still used that title, I don't like to copy anybody, so we want to be unique. I decided to title it Pretty Rosebud because we actually sing a nursery rhyme in the film that my mom used to sing to me, although I changed a little bit of the lyrics to make it more apropos for the film. And then also I completely changed the melody so as to not infringe on any rights, if there were any, because the nursery rhyme is public domain. So the nursery rhyme talks about growth and how in order for you to blossom from a pretty rosebud into a beautiful rose flower, you need to grow. And what's interesting is tying that in with the whole idea of being good. Being good is probably something we're all taught when we're little, like, you know, behave, smile, don't make too much noise. And as we grow up, being good takes on different definitions, and we need to grow in terms of what that definition is.
Yeah, sometimes that definition can hold you back.
Oh my gosh, isn't it the truth? Like, if we are just quote-unquote good, like behave well, and don't speak up, don't talk back, as an adult, that will not serve us.
One of the things I found really interesting about the film was you're talking about a character who is American, but has this other cultural background that she grew up in, and in this case, a double cultural background, because the father is Chinese, the mother is Filipino-Spanish, and so you're dealing with multiple culture clashes and expectations.
Yes. And in fact, you had mentioned that it's somewhat autobiographical. And it's entirely fiction, because I really let my imagination roll, like with the conversations and the characters and the plot points. It was fun, let's just put it that way. But I loved the foundation of the cultures that I came from. And I used so many stories that, my gosh, friends, family members, relatives, stories that I'd heard, maybe even some just rumors or gossip. And then, of course, just using my imagination, like what would happen if, and then .. So fill in the blank.
Yes, but what was great is that you had that foundation. You knew what these people might likely do.
Oh, exactly. For example, the Lola Pinning character, I did not have someone specifically like that in my life. But I had seen her at countless picnics and, you know, cultural events. I'm like, I know that character.
Now, in the film, she is your character's mother-in-law.
Yes, that's correct.
Right. That is correct. And what a character. I wanted to see more of her, actually. I enjoyed her.
Wasn't she wonderful? And here's something, you know, you talk about the foundation of cultures. I have found that other Asian cultures, or my gosh, they don't even have to be Asian. They can be Latino, European, whatever ethnic background, or even Middle Eastern. It was so interesting. I bumped into a Persian friend of mine, and she had seen the screening in Los Angeles, and she was just blown away. She was like, that was our dinner table. That was it. That father was my father. It was really neat to see how it resounds with people, regardless of your background.
Just to give a quick synopsis, your character is married to a fellow who has not been working for a while.
Yeah, over 2 years.
So yeah. She's stuck in her marriage, and she's sort of stuck at work, although things are happening there, but not necessarily what she wants to have happen. And
right.
And she's kind of at an impasse with her family as well. What is interesting, again, to me is how she finds her way through all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And figures out what she needs to do.
Yes.
How did that come about for you as the writer? Were you just sort of tossing ideas? Did you have kind of a fixed idea in mind when you started, or were you just exploring?
I was exploring all different types of possible endings or twists or characteristics, but I knew that there was a core message that I wanted to get across. And in playing with different plots and different endings, we realized, and when I say we, I mean myself, and then my husband and some my screenwriting mentors, and I know that in my, I used to study and will probably go back to, it's called a salon. It's not so much like a lecture situation, but bringing up your writing and fellow writers read it together. Everyone gets assigned a character, and you help flesh out the story. Is there enough character development? Are some characters really flat? And you know, what was really, really exciting, Bonnie, was that when I brought Pretty Rosebud, and in fact, at that point, it was called Good Girl or Tian Square was another one. The main character used to be called Tian, and oh my gosh, so many different changes. But there was so much debate on what should the main character do or not do, and when does she make the mistakes that you see in the movie, you know, not to spoil too much. But it was good to hear, because I thought, oh my gosh, people really care, and people, they're really involved, and some people are very, very passionate. At one point I had to sit back watching people argue very passionately about what should happen next in the screenplay. And I was just chuckling. It's like, well, you know, finally it's up to me, but you can argue all you want.
Well, and how great that they were that engaged in it.
Yes.
Asian women of all kinds get, I think, I mean, women in cinema tend to get very pigeonholed, period. I think Asian women get pigeonholed even tighter. Minorities of all kinds get pigeonholed even more than Caucasian women do. Was one of your goals to try to break out of what the mainstream culture expects Asian women to be like?
Absolutely. And my main way of doing that was to just show a very human, flawed character. I mean, I think a lot of times you see an element of perfection, like looking good, always speaking perfectly, behaving well, being very intelligent, having certain occupations, all of that kind of stuff. I mean, when we talked previously, you used a great word, monolith. It doesn't seem to have very many dimensions. And you'll see that the main character, she has a lot of cracks in that facade. So I really had fun just showing reality. Because we all know, I mean, you see a certain thing, especially on the TV screen, but sometimes even on the film screen, it's rather monodimensional. I was like, no, let's show the pimples. Let's show the wrinkles and the tears and the trips that a character can make. And that was a lot of fun, not only for the main character, but hopefully for everybody else as well. I mean, not just Sissy, the main character, but her husband, Phil. you don't frequently see an Asian male in media that's out of work and depressed because he's out of work. That's just not something you see. I think things are becoming more and more well-rounded, but on The Mentalist and and even Lucy Liu on her character in Elementary, I'm so glad you can start seeing some of those cracks, some of those little idiosyncrasies and flaws that actually make a character more human, more relatable, more real.
And it allows all of us to connect with characters in a way that if they're perfect, well, none of us are. And I mean, there's been lots and lots written about, you know, the dragon and all of those stereotypes about Asian women of all ethnicities.
Right.
And so it's really nice to see in this film that they're just people.
Yes. I'm so glad you feel that way, because that was definitely one of my main goals. They're just people. And I think that's something that Asian, especially Asian American actors and Latino American actors, performers, African American, you name it. We get tired of our race or our culture being portrayed just very stereotypically. And a lot of times you'll see things and we're like, well, that's not my life. Where's more of the interesting normalcy that you know occurs? And that was something else that was important for me about this story, is that, look, this family could, and this woman could be of any ethnicity, including Caucasian, European, you name it. Her problems are universal. And so hopefully people can, especially women, can look past that and see, you know, if they're in a similar situation, it's like, hey, I'm not alone. Wow, there are other people out there going through this.
And trying to find their messy way through something.
Exactly. Trying to find happiness, trying to find their true path instead of following other people's dictates and voices.
How long are you going to be in town?
Oh, very short, which is crazy because we're doing the screening and film festival tour as we speak. We are only staying till Thursday, which is, wow, that would be tomorrow, and then going back to Chicago, then flying back to L.A., and after that, we're going to the Big Island Film Festival in Hawaii. And before that, we're actually not going to go there ourselves, but we do have a screening at the Cannes Film Market. We have a sales agent taking it there. A lot of negotiation, a lot of travel. It's pretty exciting.
Well, Chudi, it has been such a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope that you'll let us know the next time you have a film out, because we'd love to have you on the show again.
Oh my gosh, Bonnie, I would love to. It was a pleasure speaking with you as well.
And welcome back home.
Thank you so much.
Actress, producer, and screenwriter Chudi Tu is originally from West Allis. Her new film, which she wrote, produced, and starred in, screens tonight at Marcus Majestic Cinema in Brookfield. It's called Pretty Rosebud. The online tickets are sold out, but anyone interested in attending the showing could come to the theater to purchase tickets on site. Tu spoke with Bonnie North. One last break, and then we'll catch up with Milwaukee's Peter Mulvey, who has a new CD and a show tomorrow night at Turner Hall. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke. Milwaukee singer-songwriter Peter Mulvey's first 15 albums have spanned a range of styles, from introspective, quiet acoustic songs to more fully produced rock songs. His 16th and newest album, Silver Ladder, falls into that second camp, but the full band accompaniment strays into some territory that gives it a distinct sound even within Mulvey's rich discography. That's thanks in large part to the influence of producer Chuck Prophet. Mulvey plays a full band show tomorrow evening at Turner Hall Ballroom, but he joined us for a solo set in Performance Studio C1, starting with a song, You Don't Have to Tell Me.
You don't have to tell me. You don't have to tell me. I already know. You don't have to tell me. You don't have to tell me.
don't have to tell me. I already know. No, you don't have to tell me. I already know.
Peter Mulvey, you don't have to tell me, in Studio C1. Peter Mulvey, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. Good to be here. Good to be here, Mitch.
It is good to see you again, and exciting that you have this new record out. It's a much more textured, more complex album, at least in terms of the arrangement. I don't want to say your writing is not complex in the previous stuff, but it is. Some of your more recent stuff is more stripped down than this. On the other hand, it's not like you've never worked with a full band before. Are you exercising a different songwriting muscle when you bring together a group of people to put together something like this?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I've been writing a lot lately. The past couple of years, I've been writing a song every Tuesday, and I knew that I wanted to make just sort of a knockdown, drag out kind of a record. And so you do, you sort of, it's more that you just put that in the back of your mind, and then your what muse, whatever you want to call it, coughs up some rock and roll tunes. But I will say, Chuck Prophet produced this record, and he took it all in direct. I mean, he practically rewrote some of the tunes. It was startling.
Well, yeah. So you had Chuck Prophet as the producer on this. He's a name that some people probably recognize, others might not. What made him the right guy for the job?
Oh, man. Because he's incredibly contrary. He's an old school rock and roller. He's like the last guy out there with a rock and roll band, sort of, you know, taking no prisoners and delivering, he's just the greatest. And I'd met him and opened a gig for him in Florida back on the road 4 or 5 years. And I called him up, and just his answer, I said, "Hey, man, I love what you do. Would you produce my record?" And he was like, "Sure, it could happen. What's your budget?" And I was like, I got $12,000, which was a lie. And he was like, "Well, then we're going to be savvy, champion. That's what's going to happen." Like, and that's the way he was the whole way through. It was like working with a crocodile on Ritalin. Like, if you come to him and say, "Okay, aesthetic choice A or B," he's like, "Why does it have to be a letter, pal? It could be a number. It could be five. It could be blue. This thing could be a bird. If it's the right bird, this tune could be flying by next Tuesday." Awesome.
It sounds kind of Confucian.
Yeah, he very much. Yeah, he was like the Zen monk that like torments you until you have a breakthrough. I spent the first night of the sessions. We made the record in L.A. and he put the band together. I spent the first night just lying awake thinking, I have made the largest mistake of this year. And then in the morning, I realized he's not being argumentative because he wants to win, and he's not being argumentative for its own sake. It actually is like those old Zen monks. The argumentation gives rise to desperation, which gives rise to new ideas. It's a way to work. I'd never done it before.
Well, you know, and at the stage of your career, do you look for something different in a producer in the whole production process than you did when you were younger? I mean, you're not looking for I don't know what you were looking for when, you know, you were writing your first songs years ago. But when you go to somebody like Chuck Prophet, you have to kind of expect something else.
Yeah. The truth is, I probably spent the first 15 years of making records with producers learning. And now I'm unlearning, if that makes sense. You build yourself an aesthetic and you build yourself something you're comfortable with. But of course, you got to knock it down. And boy, howdy, I guess I picked the right guy for this one, you know?
Is it harder to relinquish control over what comes out of a song at this stage in your career? I mean, you have, you know, umpteen hundred songs under your belt. It takes a certain amount of confidence, I would think, in the process to say, okay, I've written this, take it from here.
Yeah, it depends on the tune. The ones that came personal to me, the ones that are closest to my heart, those I still had a tendency to argue for. But I would say with the rest of them, the ones where I'm just, you know, where I'm writing what comes in and I'm not thinking about it too hard, it's actually easier than it used to be because, you know, now I've got, what is this, my 16th record, and I have well over 100, probably closing on 200 songs out there. And you start to realize that there's no such thing as the perfect iteration of a song. It lives out there and it breathes. That's what it's for.
Well, and is there a certain understanding of what your voice actually is? I mean, to use the analogy, I mean, I remember getting into this business, 20 plus years ago, and the first time I had someone in the studio with me coaching what the read should sound like, I was, you know, mortified that the thing that I heard later wasn't me. And, you know, I think years later you figure out, at least in this business, that what's you is the story you have written or the interview you have constructed. Is the same, does the same hold true for songwriting?
Oh, I think so. I think so. And I mean, I think we all have this. Anyone who does something creative has the same reaction. You're dissatisfied, immediately dissatisfied, because you're not as good as you want to be. But that's what provokes you to keep after it. And then you just get stubborn, and then 20 years go by. And you actually, I find I'm more forgiving of my early art than I was at the time. And I'm like, well, that's where that guy was. You know, give that guy a break. He's gonna grow into something, you know.
You said you're writing a song every Tuesday.
Yeah.
Which makes it good. We're having this conversation on a Wednesday, so I'm glad we're not interrupting. How does that work?
Well, basically, I have two dear old friends, funny enough, that are both originally from the Milwaukee scene here. My old friend Joe Panzetta, I was in a band with him 20-some years ago, and Pamela Means, who's still out there on the road. And we're all still out there, and we just have reconnected. And basically, the assignment is, on Tuesday, at the end of the day, you got to send in a song. And it can be fragmentary. It can be downright mediocre. But you have to send it, or you have to send guilt. You know, like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't, but I you know. And it's been really fruitful. You know, your batting average is probably goes down a little bit, as it were. You know, probably only a quarter of what I turn in is any good. But still, that's upwards of a dozen songs that I can keep and put on records a year. So
you're getting more at-bats.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And also, it takes the pressure off. I think the stupidest question you can ask as an artist is, what do I have to say? Nobody has anything to say. And even if they do, it's been said, and it's been said better by a greater artist earlier. But that's fine, because it's not a very useful question, what do I have to say? What's a very useful question is, what is interesting to me in this moment? What's the most interesting thing I can think of? What's the most exciting sound I can make now, because I'm required to make a sound, you know?
And this does not keep you from writing on a Wednesday or a Friday or a Sunday.
No, and quite often I've had like a tune on a come along on a Thursday sort of randomly, and then thought, well, I'll just send that on Tuesday. And then I think, no. Actually, no. I'm supposed to write a song this Tuesday. So it's been good. It's been good.
Well, I won't ask you when you wrote the next song you're going to play for us, but I will ask you to introduce it. What are you going to play for us?
Sure. I wrote this on a week that I had a dare to write a song every day. So this tune is called Lies You Forgot You Told.
I gave you fruit from the desert, a pocket full of stars, a glamour from the eyes of a saint. I gave you roses by the bunches and my very best hunches about everything that isn't and ain't. With any kind of look by now, it's falling on your head tenfold. A fool for believing lies you forgot you told. When you begged and you pleaded, I spoke the words you needed, although every single one burnt my tongue. I gave you faith when it deserted you, and kisses till it hurt. Climbed the silver ladder to the very top of rung, and with any kind of luck, by now it will be falling on your head tenfold. I'm a fool for believing lies I knew all along, oh, I knew all along, and I knew all along, I knew all along, oh, whoa, oh, 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 oh. I gave you handwriting and tears, an antidote to fears, a plumb line to the bottom of the well. When you asked about my secret book, I showed you every page, at least I think I did, you never can tell. Any kind of luck right now is falling on your head tenfold. I'm a fool for believing lies. Any kind of luck right now, it will be falling on your head tenfold. I'm such a fool for believing lies.
forgot you told.
Awesome.
Thank you.
To use a overused word, but it was great.
Thank you.
Peter Mulvey with Lies You Forgot You Told. That is the song that kicks off this new album.
That is, yeah.
And also the album itself gets its name from a lyric there, Silver Ladder.
Yeah, it does.
What was the catalyst for the album as a whole? I mean, you've been writing all of these songs, but when did and maybe why did you say, okay, this is when this album starts?
I think it all began actually quite a few years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. I just went through some pretty ordinary stuff. A good friend of mine died. A couple good friends of mine died. A couple of relationships near me busted up and my cat died. And it doesn't take that much. I mean, I think we tend to think of ourselves as pretty – our personality is a pretty stable edifice. But, that pretty much did me in and I came unstuck. And when I got out of the other side of the woods, because there always seems to be another side, we heal. We just do what we do. I just felt like, all right, I want to write. Like, this is a short ride. This is a real short ride. I've had that demonstrated to me. Let's have some fun. Let's write some rock and roll tunes. And the first two tunes that announced themselves, one was called What Else Was It? And another was called Trempolo. And they came in I've had a long career as a writer, and these really feel good when they come in this way. It's like they're being beamed in on the radio. They feel like they're coming from somewhere else. And once I had those, I thought, all right, I can build a record around these. And I just went to work.
Rough spells can be inhibiting, but they can also be energizing. Is there a way that you learn to use a challenge in one part of your life to your advantage in another part?
I think everyone has an instinct for that, and everyone does it in a different way. I have a very good friend, Jeffrey Foucault. You've had him on a show many times. And when I was kind of down in the storm, he said, now is when you need to be writing. I remember him sending me an email about that, and I sent him a very brief email back saying, I can't. But in my case, I felt like I had my hooks in the water the whole time while you're down there, and I feel like I managed to drag whatever it was up with me. So everyone's got their way, and that appears to be mine. It seems to be a delayed reaction for me, and that's fine. It's all good.
Yeah, it always strikes me in listening to music, and maybe it's not that different a phenomenon than in fiction or poetry or even painting, that you have this little snapshot of whatever life was like for you at a certain point in time. But a writer or a painter doesn't have to perform that part of his life over and over again. Do you have to consciously guard against writing, the open wound song? Do you have to be on the out of those woods before you can actually say,
yeah,
this is an emotion that I have nailed here?
Yeah, that's a pertinent question. I think that for me, that kind of just takes care of itself. And to me, it's a little like being an actor. I think actors are some of the only other artists that do that thing where you're recreating a moment, and you might be – in my case, I'm singing the same words and playing the same chords every night, but I'm trying to make it alive and pertinent and present. And similarly, an actor who is playing any role, they're saying the same words every night, but that's not what we're coming to see. We didn't come to see them do something they memorized. We're coming to see them have an experience. So you are sort of calling it up. And over time, you just get good at it. And it doesn't really bother me. I don't feel like I carry it home. And when I, so this, although the tunes of this record came from a pretty rough place, I feel great.
Well, and I wonder, you were talking before about being able to forgive your younger self.
Yeah.
And I wonder if some of what you're doing in writing these songs is forgiving your slightly younger self.
Oh, that's the truth. I think that's a big part of life. They say that you cannot change the past. And I suppose that that is true. But what we think of as the past is just our present memory of it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, what you can change is how you relate and the stories that you tell. You made them up anyway. Like, that much has become clear, right, by this time in our lives, we're just making up a narrative. So you may as well make one that's a little more forgiving and who knows, a little more exciting.
Well, congratulations. It's great stuff.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And what will you leave us with?
Oh, this is a tune that I co-wrote with the great Paul Sebar. This is called Back in the Wind.
Somebody started it. I got a feeling they've been gone a while. They roped me into it. There wasn't nothing I could do. I got a feeling they were just kidding about that extra mile.
Milwaukee singer-songwriter Peter Mulvey's new album is called Silver Ladder. He'll play a show with a full band tomorrow evening at Turner Hall Ballroom. Milwaukee's Vic and Gab opened the show. John Strelecki engineered this morning's interview. That's all for the Wednesday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. So great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.
Some kind of sedative slipped into what passes for my higher mind. I gotta hand it to them. They got me thinking that it's me. But I've been dreaming, wide awake, you know the flying kind. New whistle blowing, let's just go see what we can see. What do we do? They didn't say. Work it all through and back again. Put in our time, we'll labor down in. How long it gonna be till we're back in the wind? And if you wanna know the truth of it, I probably could have half-assed my way through the rest of the deal. But something wouldn't let me. Something wouldn't let me. What do we do? They didn't say. Work it on through and back again. Put it out time or labor down in. How long it gonna be till we're